name is Boris. I live in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and I watch a lot of movies. I decided this New Year's that I was going to watch a movie a day, at least. I work at a place where I basically sit in front of a laptop all day and don't do much most of the time. So I just decided I'd watch movies, not counting movies I'd go see, you know, in theaters, either new runs or repertory. And I decided that, well, if I'm going to watch all these movies, I should do something with that fact. So I'm going to do this podcast. And I'm just going to kind of talk off the cuff about, you know, the movies I watched, any relations that happened to pop into my head between them, you know, just my general thoughts about different movies. It's kind of going to be free form. I'm probably going to have a section that I'll devote to new movies I watch because, you know, people care about that a little more than whatever random old movie I happen to, you know, see recently. And so, you know, hopefully I'll talk about, you know, 7 or 8 or maybe 6 or 5 movies a week. And I'll try to do this as a weekly podcast. So hopefully my ranting and rambling makes a little bit of sense. Maybe sometimes I'll have guests on here for a slightly less deranged ranting and rambling. I'm friends with a lot of movie people, not in the industry, but movie fans. I am a movie fan. I'm not in the movie industry. Like I said, I live in Minneapolis, so not a lot of movies out here. Although there was some movie recently filmed out here. I guess it's called Wilson. I don't really know much about it. But I've been, you know, watching and thinking about movies for a long time. I have very particular views about what makes films good and bad. Although I don't really watch a lot of bad movies, because to me anyway, it's usually pretty obvious when a movie is going to be bad, so I don't even bother watching it. But I do rate the movies I watch, so I'll be talking about my rating system, you know, when I mention movies, what I've rated them. I guess I'll just give a quick intro to that. The rating system goes from 4 minuses at the worst, up to 1 minus, and then 1 plus, up to 4 pluses for the best. Although I reserve a special 5 pluses for particular movies that I think are absolutely exceptional and that sort of define something about cinema that no other movie captures quite that way. And there's only a few of those that I've seen and rated that way. I'll have a link somewhere in the description to a Google Doc of all of my movie ratings. So if anybody's curious about my dumb opinion on movies, for people who are going to inevitably ask what the pluses and minuses mean, I don't really rate movies on whether they're good or bad, because I think that a good movie might kind of be boring and like not really interesting, but very well shot and composed and acted and written and all that. Whereas a bad movie might be fascinating and might be absolutely worth watching. And that's really what my rating system is about, is to what extent is that movie worth watching? So a 3-plus movie, for instance, might be a pretty bad movie. It might, you know, have hammy acting and a dumb script and, you know, cliche cinematography or something. But something about it is exceptionally interesting, you know, such that maybe the subject matter or, you know, some particular view of society that it presents that we don't get to see a lot. And so I might rate that with a lot of pluses, because I think a lot of people should see that movie. Whereas a good example is a movie like Sunshine, which I hated, but was a very technically well-made movie. The acting was quite good. The cinematography was fantastic. But there was many, many things wrong with that movie. And maybe one day I'll talk about why I hated that movie so much. Spoilers, it was the script. But that movie I gave 3 minuses, which I think is still the lowest I've ever given a movie. I can't really see myself giving a movie 4 minuses, because I don't know why I'd even finish watching a movie that bad. But most of the time I finish watching the movies that I start. So I don't really pick movies in any particular way. I just kind of get whatever movies are interesting to me. And I watch them. Sometimes it's from recommendations. Sometimes I wiki wander and find some interesting movie. A lot of times it's just a movie that I haven't seen that I know I ought to see. Like I recently watched The Last Temptation of Christ for the first time, Scorsese, which I'd never seen before, and it's one of those movies you gotta see. It's a really important movie. It's a really fascinating movie, and I, of course, enjoyed it immensely. And for those curious, I gave it 4 pluses. Everybody should see this movie. Other times, I'll just, you know, on a lark, download something. I recently watched As Above, So Below, which is this found footage horror movie about people going into the catacombs of Paris and getting sucked into hell or something. And it was a dumb movie, but it was well done, and I enjoyed it, and had a few really cool scenes, you know, of people dying in gruesome ways. I'm not big into horror movies in general, but this one I had recommended, I think, by my roommate, who said it was a cool movie, so I, you know, got a copy, and yeah, and it was a good night of watching a horror movie. I mean, it was schlocky, and the script was dumb. It was basically Tomb Raider, the horror movie. But, yeah, it was worthwhile. Since I decided to do this one movie a night thing, I decided that I'd make a point of catching up on a lot of movies by directors whose filmographies I hadn't really had a lot of exposure to. So I recently worked through a lot of David Lynch's movies. I'm going to work through a lot of Alfred Hitchcock. Luckily, there's a Hitchcock Festival on in Minneapolis right now, so I recently saw The Wrong Man on the big screen, and I'm going to go see The Birds soon. Unfortunately, had to miss Frenzy and The Rope. I'll get copies of those at some point, and obviously there's a ton of other much more important Hitchcock that I still need to see. I've seen Psycho, but I still need to see North by Northwest, Rear Window, all sorts of stuff like that. Well, let me start by talking about a couple of recent movies I've seen, ones that have come out in theaters recently. And the two most recent ones that I think I'll talk about today are Your Name by Makoto Shinkai and Terrence Malick's new movie Song to Song. I just watched Days of Heaven for the first time in a local repertory theater called the Trilon Micro Cinema. So anybody from Minneapolis listening to this ought to go check that place out. They play incredible movies, mostly on 35mm. And they played Days of Heaven this week, which I also saw for the first time. I've been a fan of The Thin Red Line for a long time, and I also enjoyed Tree of Life quite a bit, although not quite as much as Thin Red Line. So seeing Days of Heaven, his last movie before he went on his 20-year hiatus, was really interesting this week, given that just a couple weeks ago, I watched Song to Song, which was a very, very different movie. And it feels like as he's come back from his hiatus, his hermitage, he's become much more Malicky. The movies are much floatier now. Days of Heaven was a much more grounded movie, both narratively and cinematically. The shots were, you know, there were a lot of abstract wide shots of the fields in which they were working and of the fire at the end. But in his more recent movies, the shots have gotten much stranger. There's the camera looks up a lot. It's at ground level very often, so we get these very strange foreshortened images of the actors. In The Thin Red Line, we get a lot of shots of treetops, which we also see in Tree of Life quite a bit. And it's very, you know, impressionistic and introspective. And it gives the audience a lot of time to sort of stew in the imagery and kind of think about what narrative there is in the movie. Whereas in Song to Song, it's much more concentrated on the bodies of the characters. What really interested me about the movie is how obsessed it is with these characters. And in a way that lots of character dramas aren't. Lots of character dramas are concerned with the interactions between the characters, the sort of relationships between them. Whereas Song to Song seems much more focused on the characters' opinions of each other, the sort of the way they see each other. And see is very important here because I think what Malick is really trying to do with this movie is he's trying to show us the distinction between ideal and reality. So at the beginning of this movie, we have all these incredibly beautiful people, you know, Ryan Gosling, Michael Fassbender, Natalie Portman, they're forming these really shallow relationships based on each other's appearance. You know, Michael Fassbender picks up Natalie Portman in a diner because she's wearing, you know, a tight shirt and a short skirt. The relationship between Rooney Mara and Ryan Gosling is a little more developed, but it's a very sort of high school level sort of romance. They're clearly in, like, you know, very mushy kind of puppy love, but they're both so concerned with themselves, you know, with how they're being perceived, with what opportunities these relationships can give them, that they don't really ever see each other, you know, as the other person. And I think that Malick is doing something very specific with a element of film that you don't see discussed very often in film criticism, at least not in my experience, which is he's using the blocking of the characters and the way the characters move to express this distinction between how the characters really are and how the other characters perceive them. So in Song to Song, the characters are constantly moving. Nobody ever sits still when they're with another person. They're always pacing the room. They're sitting down for a moment, then getting back up and walking to the other side of the room. Or they're, you know, dancing, or they're at a party, walking around, getting a drink. Almost nobody is ever still. There's no, you know, two people sitting across a table from each other. One of them always has to be moving the chair around or fidgeting with something at the table, you know, crossing and uncrossing their legs. And the only times you see people actually stay still for a bit, for most of the movie anyway, is when they're alone. So there's a lot of scenes of Rooney Mara with her, presumably her sisters, and their kids, the sisters' kids, where she just sits still on the ground, and the kids move around her because they're kids, they run around, and, you know, maybe the sisters walk past or whatever, but when she's in that environment, she's able to stop and actually be herself for a bit. Whereas in every other scene, just about throughout the movie, she's moving, and all the other characters are moving, as if they don't want to be caught, as if they don't want their real selves to be visible, to be graspable for more than a moment at a time. And it's not until the end of the movie, when Ryan Gosling's character meets his ex-girlfriend again, played by Licky Lee, that he kind of realizes that, you know, he sort of threw away this past relationship, and he realizes that he doesn't want to throw away the relationship he has with Rooney Mara's character. When he comes to that realization at the end, and he sort of matures, and he finds Rooney Mara again, and she has kind of come to terms with the fact that she's not going to succeed as a musician. And she's also sort of decided that she needs to kind of figure out a place in the world for herself, emotionally, if not financially, because that doesn't seem to be a big problem for her. That's when you finally see them in a room together, not moving around each other. They're still, finally, they sit. They look at each other. They, you know, touch each other's hair. But they don't have this manic, constant movement like we see with all the other characters throughout the movie. And it just fascinates me that how stark this is. When I first noticed this while watching the movie, I maybe noticed it a third of the way through that these characters are constantly moving. And it struck me like, well, why? Like, why are they doing this? And why don't we see characters moving like this more often? And I decided that what's really happening here is that Malick is showing this distinction between how people really are when they're still, when you can apprehend them, versus how they idealize each other and themselves, what they want to be, what they want other people to be. But that those ideals aren't real. They're sort of a mirage. They're an illusion. That you have to constantly be moving, be changing yourself, be, you know, running like the Red Queen to maintain. And that we surround ourselves with these illusions and with people who maintain these kinds of illusions. And that people have to do a lot of work in order to present their ideal self to others, and a lot of work to maintain their idealized versions of other people in their own heads. And that's like really what this movement of these characters is about, is them working so hard to idealize the world around them and refusing to stop and see the real world around them. So instead of going for various kinds of, you know, filters or particular angles or certain kinds of framing in order to show this like a lot of other movies would, although maybe that's there as well, I was quite focused on the character blocking while I watched it. Malick manages to present this distinction. So what I started saying was that I noticed this movement about a third of the way into the movie, and I started trying to keep track of when do the characters move around, when do they stay still. And it clicked immediately. Anytime a character was still, they're almost always alone or in some sort of context outside of this world of beautiful people on the concert circuit, trying to make it big, trying to make money. They were with their families. They were alone. They were in uncomfortable social situations where, you know, they kind of retreated into themselves. And then at the end, like I said, when they finally accepted the reality of their relationships, when they stopped trying to idealize their partners, when they stopped trying to date the version of the person they had in their own heads, and finally stopped and saw the real person who was there in front of them, which I think really is what we all hope to do in relationships. Not that I'm an expert, but as compared to what most of us actually do, is build up this other person in our heads and then try to date that person and try to fall in love with this image, even often realizing that that's all it is an image that we've created. And then being upset when the real person falls short of that image. But that's really the human condition, and is that fault. It's a sort of cognitive bias we have. And of course, we don't have access to the true inside person within another person's head. That's just not possible, at least not yet. So we sort of rely on these images we create. But I think what Malick is trying to tell us is that we need to stop and we need to really study the other person. We need to commit to understanding the other person on their own terms. And we need to work together with the other person. We both need to be still. And that's really what I think Michael Fassbender's character shows us throughout the movie. He's never still. He's twice as agitated as anybody else. I mean, it probably has to do with the amount of coke he's doing as well, but he's constantly moving back and forth in every sex scene. He's doing flips and he's pulling people left and right. You know, he's running around the room as compared to, say, the prostitute they talk to, which, as far as I could tell, might be a real prostitute. I should probably look it up, but she certainly played one very convincingly. And she was pretty still. She just kind of stood there and looked out the window while, you know, Michael Fassbender was cavorting with another naked woman. And she just talked about her real experience, about, you know, how getting paid for sex isn't that fun, you know, that it's a job, that it's a matter of, you know, careful, keeping a careful distance from other people. And there, it's an incredible thing that he included this character, because her entire job, essentially, isn't to have sex with someone, although, you know, on some level, that is her job. It's to present this ideal image of a woman, you know, whatever woman you want, she will be. In fact, that's her job. And she talks about how that's really the challenge and in some ways to her, the interest of the job, even though she doesn't really want to be doing it. But that's what, you know, that's the interesting thing for her, is the fact that she has to present this ideal to other people. And I think that's really what's at the heart of this movie, is, you know, the people feeling like they are forced to be these ideal people for each other and falling into the trap of thinking that that's how the world really is. I want to move on and talk about the other recent movie I saw. Well, it's relatively recent. It premiered in America at the beginning of April, but it's been out in Japan since the summer, I believe. Now, Your Name is ostensibly a science fiction movie. It's an animated movie. And it's directed by Makoto Shinkai, who got famous for producing and animating a movie entirely by himself called Voices of a Distant Star. Now, that movie was about a couple, a teenage couple, who communicated to each other via text on their cell phones because the girl was recruited to pilot a giant robot in space and fight aliens. What this meant was that she was traveling at near light speed a lot of the time, meaning that she experienced huge time dilation. And where she was texting her boyfriend basically right away whenever she would get a text from him, because time was going much slower for her, he would only receive a text once a year, once every few years. And so you watched how their relationship sort of failed to develop in a sense because she was still 16 or whatever while he got older and older and his life, you know, moved on. And Makoto Shinkai has always been very interested in time and how time and differences in time affect human relationships. 5 centimeters per second also involved some time manipulation, not really time travel, or time differences between people and how they affected things. So Your Name has to do with a teenage boy and girl who realize they're swapping bodies with each other when they fall asleep and sort of experience the other person's life as if it were a dream. And they do this a couple times a week, apparently. And, of course, over the course of the movie, they fall in love because it's a movie about teenagers. But then we find out that actually the girl is living 3 years in the past relative to the boy, and that 3 years ago, a meteorite struck the town she was in and she was killed. But the problem is that when they wake up from the dreams, they don't really remember details about the other person's life. It's a dream. So things fade shortly after they wake up. They might remember each other's names for a little while, hence the title, but then it disappears, leaving them asking, "What's your name?" Kimi no na wa. Now, this movie is just as beautiful, if not more, than Makoto Shinkai's other works. He kind of became well-known, or I should say he popularized what's called scenery porn, where he has incredibly lush drawings, backgrounds, of forests, of mountains, of lakes and rivers that he spends a lot of time showing you. He's very famous for very beautifully rendered pink and blue skies, so a lot of sunsets and sunrises. Lots of, you know, cumulonimbus clouds towering up to the stratosphere. And this movie is no exception. It's absolutely full of this sort of thing. There's a particular scene where the characters go to see the body of their local god, which is a large rock formation in the very center of the caldera of an extinct volcano. And this caldera is full of grass and bushes, and also full of these, I guess you can call them small ponds or puddles. So when Mitsuha, the girl who lives in this small village, which this extinct volcano is near to, when she goes there with her grandma and little sister, because her family has run this shrine, which of which this god is the patron, as it were, when they go there, their grandma tells them that as they step into the water, that surrounds the body of this god, they're stepping into the underworld, which the little sister very enthusiastically does, jumping into the water and running straight into the underworld. And when later in the movie Taki, the boy who's in love with Mitsuha, who lives in Tokyo, 3 years in the future, when he decides he needs to find Mitsuha's village to see if he can somehow get in touch with her again after the meteor strikes and kills her, he finds this caldera and he goes to the shrine of this, or to the body of the shrine's god. There's a scene when he finally gets to the water that surrounds the body of this god, and he sort of vaguely remembers that Mitsuha's grandma told her that this was the entrance to the underworld. And he comments on this to himself and then steps into the water. And this is extremely reminiscent and must be deliberately reminiscent of the scene in Princess Mononoke when they arrive at the grove where the main character first sees the forest god. It's the same sort of lush greenery with this shallow water, and it's clearly, meant to be reminiscent of sort of a passage into the underworld. So I thought that was a very beautiful touch. This movie throughout indulges in the scenery porn concept. It's the small town that Mitsuha is from is surrounded by trees. It's gorgeous. There's lots of shots of the lake that it's near to. From Taki's side of things, Tokyo is so lovingly rendered. You could almost see the rivets on every, subway car. The buildings are gorgeously done. The skyline's amazing. The Tokyo's full of trees and birds and people. And the people are, for the most part, hand animated, as far as I can tell. I think the characters were animated in CG for some parts, but for the most part, yeah, it's hand drawn. I mean, hand drawn into a computer, but nonetheless, 2D. There's a scene where Mitsuha and her little sister perform a dance for the shrine, which I suspect is actually 3D rendered, but very expertly cel-shaded and probably manually manipulated so that it looks 2D. But a dance, intricate, very precise and fluid dance, would be much easier to animate in 3 dimensions than in 2, which, I guess I can't really fault them for. It's a matter of budget. Although I'm a big fan of everything in an animation being 2D, outside of the Disney style of very lush, sort of 3D production, Disney Pixar, I guess I mean. But Taki's Tokyo is so precisely rendered. It's actually kind of strange when you think about it. Why would you go to all this trouble of animating a movie and then spending a bunch of time and effort to draw a city that you could have shot, in live action? Certainly, it's cheaper to just get a camera up and, fly it on a drone or something around Tokyo and get all these scenes. Why would you bother to draw things in such precise detail? And I think what's happening here is something that is very particular to anime, to Japanese animation, and that's an attempt to show the real world as sort of hyper real, to express emotions about the world, about a location, through this incredibly detailed depiction of it in this incredibly contrived medium of animation. While thinking about anime recently, it struck me how strange it is that so much anime is set very firmly in the real world of Japan. You see a person's kitchen and there's dirty dishes and there's water dripping from the sink and there's a label on the soap. There's like weird implements and there's week-old vegetables in the fridge. Why would you bother drawing that? In Western animation, we pretty much never see that. Even when Western animation is aping anime, such as Avatar: The Last Airbender, you don't see that attention to detail. So why is anime so obsessive, almost universally, with this minutia of day-to-day life in Japan? And I think in part it's a Japanese cultural like thing of them seeing themselves as sort of the singular country they really are. Clearly, all countries are singular in their own way, but Japan was isolated for hundreds of years from the outside world and developed so much of their own way of doing things that's, I mean, not completely different, but that's stylistically unique to Japan. Their culture is very inward-looking, and not in some essentialist way, but just historically, they've, you know, it's the only country that speaks Japanese. They, you know, had their own entire social structure that was, you know, somewhat influenced by Chinese and Korean culture, but, you know, was so peculiar to Japan. And Japanese people, like, really don't, like, model themselves on people in the West outside of, you know, the sort of cultural tropes that were put upon them by America. First with the, you know, opening of the country in the late 1800s, and then with obviously World War II. I think the real upshot I'm trying to get at is that for certainly some Japanese people, there's this sort of genuine non-jingoistic love for Japan and for the details of Japanese life. And so I think that's what anime in general, a lot of the time, and Your Name in particular, is trying to express with these incredibly detailed depictions of life in Tokyo. They want to show that these train cars, these buildings, these roads, you know, these people on the street and in cafes and, you know, cooking food in stalls in the streets, that the Makoto Shinkai wants the audience to really look at these people and see them in a sort of, you know, hyper focus. Really appreciate the sort of quiet beauty of life in this country, of, you know, this culture they all share. And that's why he would go to all this trouble of animating something so seemingly mundane in such detail. There might be particular places, particular intersections or street corners, particular, you know, railway stations or, you know, monuments that are seen, but because they're animated, you don't necessarily see them as just, you know, that place I pass on my way to work. You can abstract away from the actual location and just see the one thing he's showing you on screen at that time, because it's a drawing, because, you know, you can't help but think of it as a drawing on some level, even though on another level, you can't help but think of it as the actual place, because it is so detailed. And I think it's wonderful that it lets you kind of take a completely fresh look at this, you know, scenery, at this place that you would otherwise be extremely familiar with. And this, of course, contrasts with Mitsuha's hometown, which is an invented town around a lake which happened to itself be formed 1,000 years earlier by a meteor strike, which is a made-up town and therefore completely invented by the artists who made the movie. And I think this is a fitting dichotomy that is reflective of the fact that these characters are switching bodies and getting to experience the sort of fake dream reality, even though they realize that each of them is a real person. The things they do when they're in the other person's body kind of don't have a real effect on their own life back home. So in that same way, there's this, you know, dichotomy between the hyper reality of your waking life and the sort of invented reality of your dream life. And there's a pleasant symmetry when each of the characters goes to the home of the other. Mitsuha, 3 years in the past, gets on a train one day and goes to try to find Taki. And it turns out that she does find him, coincidentally, but he doesn't know who she is because it's still 3 years in the future before he meets her. And then 3 years in the future, Taki decides he has to find out, you know, he has to meet Mitsuha because he doesn't realize or doesn't remember from his dream that these, you know, her life is 3 years in the past. So he gets on a train and goes to try to find her town, but of course her town doesn't exist anymore because it got wiped out by a meteor strike. And during his search, he finally realizes, well, he finds her town, but then realizes, oh, maybe if he goes to this, the place where the shrine's god is, in this caldera, he could meet her. And they finally meet in the middle, around the shrine. And this is really about. It's the city meeting the country. It's, the boy meeting the girl. It's about, the harmony that can exist between them if they sort of meet in the middle. And of course, this is very reflective of sort of what's happening in Japan now with the sort of depopulation of the country, the aging of the rural population with all the young people moving to the city. And Makoto Shinkai's sort of ideal dream of a sort of viable life in the country for young people. Even though, of course, Mitsuha hates living in the country and, says she wishes she could be reborn as a handsome Tokyo boy. But in the end, she, comes to accept and love this town in part because of Taki's experience in her body and how he changes, people's reactions to her and her own feelings towards, her friends and family. And of course, then there's the meteor strike, which wipes out this town. Now, I didn't realize when I first saw it, because I was so focused on various other things in the movie, that this is obviously a direct reference to the Tohoku earthquake and the Fukushima Daiichi disaster, which, could have been significantly worse, not to downplay it. But this is a issue that, Japanese culture is grappling with nowadays. The recent Godzilla remake, Shin Godzilla, was, a very direct reference to this, of, the destruction of a Japanese city due to some sort of nuclear, natural disaster, nuclear disaster. And of course, with the incompetence or, ass saving of the Japanese bureaucracy, which to some extent plays a role in this movie as well, with Mitsuha's father, sort of estranged father, being the mayor of the town and sort of refusing to believe that this meteor was going to strike, and Mitsuha and Taki having to sort of work in sequence to convince him, and eventually, luckily, succeeding. But after the town is saved, the connection between Taki and Mitsuha is sort of broken because their history has been changed effectively. The town was destroyed and now it's no longer destroyed. And when each of them wakes up from their, dream of being in the other person's body, they very quickly forget the details again. And this is slightly inconsistently handled, sort of like the forgetting in Memento or, various other movies that play fast and loose with memory. But it's still very thematically, poignant and appropriate. And the characters never, just conveniently remember for an extra day or whatever. It's always very hazy, just like dreams. It's very honest to that experience, I think, of just remembering certain parts of a dream and not being sure, if they were part of the same dream or what. But they start to forget as soon as sort of their connection is broken, which is really, I think, why a lot of people are going to see this movie multiple times. Including myself, I went to see it 3 times over 3 weekends. It's because we've all experienced this sort of the like end of a relationship and sort of forgetting what it was about the other person that we found so incredible. In certain cases where we're not dumped or it doesn't end in acrimony, where we are left with a negative impression of the other person. But sort of relationships is just sort of and, for reasons of scheduling or, because somebody moved or something or because it was never meant to be. And it's very hard to hold on to that emotional core of a relationship like that. So I think a lot of people are reacting to that and are remembering their relationships from when they were younger, and especially older people, which, as I understand, many older people in Japan, in particular, are going to see this movie multiple times and are coming out of it crying because the emotion of that sort of young love that they're trying to remember is so beautifully expressed in this movie. I rated both Song to Song and Your Name 4 pluses. I wouldn't be surprised if, on some further consideration, I actually bump Your Name up to 5 pluses, because it really is a truly exceptional movie. It brings just such genuine emotion to what seems otherwise a very fanciful story, you know, people changing bodies and jumping across time and, you know, changing historical events and the like. But all of that narrative structure is really just built on a core of these incredible characters and their very genuine, very heartfelt emotional connections with each other. With each other and with, you know, their towns, their families, their cultural and historical roots. It's really a movie that transcends its genre and its medium in so many ways, and really uses the strengths of both the science fiction genre to really strain a relationship and see how far you can stretch it and what people will go through to protect, you know, their love, as well as the medium of animation, which is used perfectly to express this sort of love for a place, love for a, you know, a particular culture and environment that gets to be rendered in such loving detail that simply, you know, taking a camera out into a street or out into a random patch of forest can't really do, because you know that the image on screen isn't imbued with, like, pure emotion, basically, which it has to be when you're animating it, because everything is de novo, you know, everything is created by the artists. So everything is precisely where they want it to be, where they need it to be in order to express what they want to express. I wanted to talk about some of the other movies I watched this week, but I feel like I had more than enough to say about these two movies that this is pretty good for a first run through. So I guess we'll see what the reception is and for this podcast, and I'll maybe do another one sooner than a week from now and talk about the various movies I watched this week. Maybe I'll do kind of two separate streams, one for kind of older movies I watch that I just, you know, decide to watch, and one for new movies that I watch as they come out. Although this one might be a little rarer because I don't go see that many new movies. There, you know, are so many old movies that I haven't seen yet that I need to see, and the kind of retrospective viewings I'll be doing of various directors, I might sort of leave out some movies I watch so that I can talk about an entire, you know, oeuvre in a single episode if I've watched a lot of movies by that director recently, such as I recently did with David Lynch. But we'll see how people like this, just me rambling incoherently into a microphone while I sit at work. Hopefully, you know, most of what I said more or less made sense, or at least gave you something to think about. Feel free to, you know, let me know your thoughts on what I've said, or on this podcast, its format, or its content, or anything like that. I'll put some links to articles that gave me some of these thoughts, especially about Your Name. There's a, I believe, New Yorker and an Atlantic article that really directly, you know, I got a lot of things from, so I'll put links to that. I'll put whatever other links I can think of that might be relevant that I've drawn from recently. Feel free to contact me at boris@donutradio.com if you think that's the best way to get in touch with me. Otherwise, since probably most people who listen to this will already know me, you can just message me on whatever social media. I technically have a Twitter, which is @Cthulju, CThulJew. So presumably you can find me on there, or on Facebook. I think most of my profile is public anyway. So let me know what you think about anything, and hopefully you'll keep listening. Thanks. Bye.